20 years ago, on August 19, 1991, hardline members of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the KGB attempted to seize control of the country from Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. The abortive coup paved the way for the collapse of the Soviet Union by the end of 1991. Hello, I'm Pavel Butorin, and you're listening to The Blender, the weekly podcast from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. This is episode 32 of The Blender, and on this show we're going to listen to Boris Nemtsov, a Russian opposition leader, reminisce about the events of 1991 and reflect on what went wrong after the collapse of the Soviet Empire.
It was very interesting days and very romantic days. Thousands of Russian people together with a feeling of solidarity protect our country.
And then I'm going to talk with my colleagues from the Armenian, Ukrainian and Uzbek services of Radio Free Europe about how they feel about being part of the so-called post-Soviet space.
This is another invention, because there is no post-Soviet space. The post-Soviet space is just a fiction.
Well, I can't believe it's been 20 years, but Friday, August 19, marks the 20th anniversary of what became known in Russia as the August Putsch. What happened, in brief, was that a group of top Communist Party and security officials who didn't like Mikhail Gorbachev's reforms and were opposed to a new union treaty of the already crumbling Soviet Union, they tried to isolate the country's leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, who was vacationing in the south. They tried to take control and restore order in the country, as he called it. And a lot of important events had taken place in Soviet republics prior to that, but what happened was Vice President Gennady Yanayev declared himself acting president because Gorbachev was supposedly ill and unable to perform his duties. So they tried to declare a state of emergency. They banned most newspapers in Moscow, but the plotters were opposed by a mass campaign of civil resistance. And of course, Boris Yeltsin, the then president of the Russian Federation inside the Soviet Union, took the lead, and eventually the coup was defeated. Gorbachev returned to Moscow, but things were never the same, and Soviet republics declared independence one by one, and by the end of 1991, the Soviet Union ceased to exist. So that's a brief and very simple account of those events. But we are going to speak with Russian opposition politician Boris Nemtsov, who was a member of the Russian parliament at the time and a close ally to President Yeltsin, and who was among the defenders of the White House, the then Russian parliament, who helped turn things around. Nemtsov spoke with my colleague, Rob Coulson.
It's been 20 years since the anti-Gorbachev coup attempt, and I'd like to start by asking you to take us back to that moment in your life. Where were you, what were you doing, and what were your hopes and expectations at that time?
That historical days, I was in the White House. I was a deputy of Russian parliament, and I was with Yeltsin, like a protector of White House and freedom in Russia. Really, it was very interesting days and very romantic days, I want to tell you. Well, I decided in 19th of August of 91 to travel on vacation, but the beginning of vacation starts from coup. And I asked my wife that, unfortunately, vacation is over and I will go to the White House. It was a very romantic time. Thousands of Russian people together with a feeling of solidarity protect from communism our country and won. I think that this is a very rare event in the history of Russia, and I'm very proud that I took part in that. I was not far from Yeltsin when he proclaimed his historical speech about the tank, and he said that this is completely illegal, anti-constitutional, and anti-Russian. And without microphone even, or maybe he had microphone, but nobody heard him, but everybody understands that this is the most important speech of the president in his life. After that, I presented him, when he was retired, I presented him special steel tank and a very big Yeltsin on that, like a gift on his birthday. And he said, why tank is smaller than me? I respond that because millions of Russians and billions in the world believed that at that time you were bigger than every tank in the world.
Was there a moment during the last 20 years when you realized to yourself that the hopes and expectations of that time, of 1991, were going to be disappointed or at least delayed?
Well, I understand at that time that this is very important days of my country. And really, it was the death of the communism. We understand that very, very careful. But we were very romantic. We believe that the way to freedom and successful life will be much shorter than we recognize later. I was sure that to come from communism means a great life in a few months. We were very naive, not only me, but Yeltsin and all of our team. We were very naive. We believe that just to dismiss communists and we'll be lucky. But unfortunately, reality looks much more serious and much more complicated than we believe at that time.
Do you think that during the 1990s there were opportunities for the West to exert a stronger influence on developments in Russian democracy? Or was Russia's failure to develop a democracy partly a failure of the Western attitude toward Russia?
I want to tell you that the West did not play a huge role in the history of Russia, and in particular in the 90s. The Westerners really supported democracy in Russia, that's true. But as far as economic support is concerned, I believe that it was absolutely limited and it was not enough to be successful. Just one example. It was huge talks between West and Russia about Soviet debt. And the Westerners insisted Yeltsin to pay Soviet debt. And Soviet debt at that time was huge, was $100 billion. But anyway, the West didn't pay any attention on the economic situation of the country, and the country was under Soviet Union bankruptcy, and oil prices were very small. Price was about maybe between $10 and $15 per barrel, not like now. But the Westerners didn't pay any attention. They asked their guys, if you are a successor, you must pay. That's why the economy was in the very terrible shape. And the economic situation was very difficult, huge inflation and disintegration. But anyway, they pressed very much us to pay this debt. I think that it was the biggest mistake of the world. And economic situation was very difficult, and Russian people felt themselves in a big trouble. And now millions of Russians believe that August 91 was the beginning of a huge difficulties.
And looking forward now, what is your opinion of the current reset policy between Russia and the United States? Has it been helpful to Russia's domestic development?
I want to tell you that the U.S. policy concerning Russia is very limited. And American influence in my country is, I don't know, is nothing, I want to tell you. Of course, Putin propaganda used a story about American imperialism, that America wants to destroy the country and wants to keep the country in American imperialistic hands. And he used all anti-American rhetorics, especially in so-called elections, right? But if you look in the situation in the country, American influence is nothing now. Nothing. That's why I don't think that I can tell you something concretely about what is the real influence of American government to Russian domestic affairs. Maybe except one point. Now Congress decided to adopt a so-called cousin list. Cousin list is a list of persons who violated constitutional rights of Russian people, who are responsible for Khodorkovsky arrest, who are responsible for Magnitsky death, who are responsible for violation of elections and freedom of speech. And this is really very important. If American Congress will adopt that, it will be very important to promote democracy in Russia. But as far as I know, State Department doesn't want to support this project in the Congress, and that's why in the upcoming autumn it will be huge fighting about this project.
And one last question about the other countries of the former Soviet Union. Just the expression former Soviet Union seems sort of strange because the 15 countries have gone in such different directions. I'm wondering, have there been developments in the other non-Russia countries of the former Soviet Union over the last two decades that have surprised you?
Well, the biggest winner is Estonia. Estonia is a part of the European Union and first former Soviet Republic with euro currency and with huge Standard & Poor's rating. Congratulations. And Baltic states look very good as far as democracy is concerned and look very good as far as a member of European Union and NATO. But I believe that this is like an exemption. The rest have faced a lot of difficulties. Ukraine was a symbol and an example of democracy. But now, after the arrest of Tymoshenko, I believe that what we are looking forward is Putinization of Ukraine or Lukashenkoization of Ukraine. Because everybody understands that this is political motivated arrest. Everybody understands that this is not fighting against corruption, but this is an attempt to fight against opposition. And unfortunately, Putin experience was very attractive for Yanukovych government. That's why I believe that democracy in Ukraine is in a big trouble. As far as Belarus is concerned, it's very easy. You know? This is an example of dictatorship. This is an example of huge repression against political opposition. And unfortunately, even after sanctions in Europe and in the state, Lukashenko is still control situation. And the Putin government, yes, they hate each other, but Putin government, as far as economy is concerned, strongly support very inefficient Lukashenko model of planning and state corrupted economy. That's why I want to tell you that the worst situation in the Slavic countries, of course, is in Belarus. As far as Kazakhstan, Kazakhstan is an example of crony capitalism, Asian style. Yes, Nazarbayev, he is a dictator and he is a leader forever after the death. And this is an example where so-called parliament adopted his status forever, which is absolutely terrible. But the West didn't pay any attention in the dictatorship in Kazakhstan. The same situation, even worse, happened in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan and Turkmenistan. And this is an example of Asian style of dictatorship with some factors from Muslims and with a huge danger from Afghanistan and from Iran. Generally speaking, a majority of former Russian republics look like dictatorship. Another maybe exemption is Georgia. Yes, Saakashvili wants power forever, but on the other hand, there is opposition and there is free press. And there is huge success as far as anti-corruption policy is concerned. And Georgia looks very well in terms of investment climate, in terms of taxation system, in terms of anti-corruption policy. That's why it looks like a successful country. But on the other hand, Saakashvili wants to keep power forever. And I don't know when this power will change. That's why it's not so easy situation even inside Georgia. As far as Armenia, Armenia is very strong dependent on Putin, Russia, and that's why policy inside the country is not independent. And Azerbaijan looks like quite independent as far as economy, but dictatorship is still continuing because Aliyev, it looks like monarchy. Old Aliyev decided to transform power to his son, and new Aliyev is thinking how to transform this power to his kids, etc. This is not democracy, this is dictatorship, this corruption, etc. That's why I don't think that such kind of development is what Azerbaijanian people believe. The main point of this description is that the way to freedom and democracy, first of all, looks like marathon. Secondly, a very complicated situation inside. Third, opposition is very split in every country, and I don't know how many years do we fight to achieve democracy and freedom. Well, but what is important as far as foreign, Western policy is concerned, is to think about common and fundamental values. Don't think about just gas and oil, like sometimes Italians, Berlusconi, and some German politicians believe. I don't think that if policy will base just on gas and oil, you will find some predictable and stable situation in the east of Europe. That's why I think that fundamental values are what you have to take into account as far as European former Soviet Union Republic policy is concerned.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all my questions. We really appreciate your talking to us.
This was Boris Nemtsov, a Russian opposition leader, speaking to our correspondent Rob Colson. Up next, our broadcasters from the Armenian, Ukrainian, and Uzbek services talk about their country's efforts, or lack thereof, to break away from their Soviet past.
З вами Радіо Свобода.
Радіо Фарда Кушніка.
Айче Радіо Европа. Машал
Радіо. Азатить Радіоса.
Азатицюн Кетеєм.
28 languages, 21 countries, one voice. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Joining me now are Natalia Churikova of the Ukrainian service, Alisher Siddiqov of RFERL's Uzbek service, and Harry Tamrazian of the Armenian service. And we're meeting, of course, on the 20th anniversary of the failed coup in Moscow in August 1991, which ultimately hastened the collapse of the Soviet Union. I wanted to talk to some of the people from our other former Soviet countries and see what they think about how things have developed over the past 20 years. 20 years on, where do we go from now? And why don't we start with Armenia? Harry Tamrazian of the Armenian service, has been 20 years, and obviously a lot has happened. But looking back at the national and nationalist, perhaps, aspirations of Armenia's independence leaders at the time, would you say these aspirations have been fully achieved?
Well, in terms of in achieving independence, yes, I should say that, yeah, they are independent, and it's a great achievement for Armenians, and I'm really, as part of that community and nation, I'm also proud, because I was there. I was watching very closely what's happening with the independent movement, and I should say, yes, that's a great achievement that we have.
Right now, though, how independent really is Armenia? Well, economically, yeah. Politically?
No, I mean, you cannot say that there is any nation on the earth that is independent economically, because we're living now in a global economy. As you see, Armenia economically is not, of course, independent, and it depends very much on the remittances that many Armenians living around the world are sending to their relatives back to Armenia. And in this sense, I think Armenia's economy depends on Russian economy, on the U.S. economy, and the European economy. If these economies are growing, then we are in a good shape, because our relatives in these countries and continents are sending...
Remittances, that's an interesting subject, and that's probably relevant for Uzbekistan, Alisher. Is that something that also a sign of, you know, lesser independence of let's say, Central Asian countries in any case?
Absolutely. I mean, Uzbekistan is, in Central Asia, is the largest exporter of labor force to Russia, and you know, they're sending back billions of dollars that consist of larger amount of state budget, even bigger than official budget of the republic, and the dependence is absolutely there, and Russia can play this card, and they're doing that in terms of Tajikistan, and so this is the nightmare for Karimov, to think about how this game can turn, what this game can turn out if Russia decide to expel migrants or limit the migrants.
Natalia, how about Ukraine? Ukraine seems to be linked very closely with Russia economically because of the gas contracts and everything. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Today in the morning, I was listening to the Czech radio, and they were discussing how Ukrainian orange leaders of the Orange Revolution are fiercely fighting now in the Ukrainian courts, accusing each other of making a bad deal with Russia.
Tymoshenko and Yushchenko,
exactly. And what they said is that where Ukraine reformed its economy early on, it would not need a single drop of Russian gas. It leads us to the question, how long these countries will still be called post-Soviet. They're called post-Soviet for a reason, because the Soviet legacy still lasts. And it lasts everywhere, from politics to economics to social problems, even moral problems. Poll after poll tells us that Ukrainians get more and more disappointed about the results of independence. But we have to understand that the expectations were huge. The expectations were that Ukraine would be like Germany, that it would have a powerful economy, that it has agriculture, that it has natural resources. This country had everything to succeed, and it failed in the most miserable way because the Soviet nomenclature, the Soviet apparatchiks, they stayed in power, and people were not prepared for independence and not prepared for democracy.
You made a good point about how, you know, the same apparatchiks stay in power for so long, and in Central Asia, in Uzbekistan, you have Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, you have people who have stayed in power for 20 years, and it's the same people who were there 20 years ago. So it's a little problematic to talk about the way forward, if you know what I mean. You know?
Absolutely. I mean, the way they think, it's absolutely the way that they continue this Soviet legacy, and they're continuing everything, you know, starting from controlling over the ideology, persecution for ideas, imprisonment, repressions. So this is all happening in Uzbekistan. So really, you don't have anything different except from that during Soviet Union, there was some kind of accountability. You know, these presidents were accountable to the center. They could not be really corrupt. Corruption was much, much less. Infrastructure much, much better. Education, social protection was much, much better. So they took that part off and they said, this is, you know, this market economy. We're not responsible for this. But they did not take, but then they retained what we don't want, what people didn't want to retain, stuff like I told you, you know, human rights, yeah. Abuses and everything.
Harry, how about Armenia? In Armenia, how has the political elite evolved? What happened to those independence leaders that were active 20 years ago?
The independence leaders are still around, and they have huge impact to this day even, and they're in very actively engaged in the local politics. We don't have nomenclature now, Soviet nomenclature. They're all gone. So the first thing these independence leaders done, they just got rid of this old nomenclature. But it did not change the situation. I think the question is not about whether nomenclature stayed or not. The question was the society reformed, really? Was there a reform package that was implemented? No. The answer is absolutely no. They were trying to reform from the very first days, and there was privatization of the land, you know, introduction of a national currency. But, you know, nothing really happened on the ground. You know, the freedoms, human rights, you know, all these issues, democratic institutions, they are not there yet. Without having independent parliament, legislative and executive and judiciary, we cannot talk about, you know, democratic countries.
That's right. Here's something else I wanted to talk to you all about, language and culture. I'll share a little personal anecdote. It always seemed to me that many Russians believed, largely because of the propaganda, that, and it was actually the Soviet anthem, that Russia brought together all these nations into one friendly big family. And I have to admit that that's something I thought growing up in Russia. And then the first time I traveled to Western Ukraine in the 80s when I was an adolescent, I saw that sentiment wasn't exactly reciprocated. And it was quite a shock for me as a kid. And even now when you watch any meeting between leaders from Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, you know, they always talk about our cultural and linguistic unity and how we sort of belong together. And honestly, I think that feeling is shared by a lot of Russians in Russia. But in Ukraine, is that something that Ukrainians believe? Do they think of Russians as, you know, a brotherly nation?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Probably about half of the country would still think that Russians are the closest people to Ukrainians, and about half of the country will not think this way. They will not think in those terms. They will not think right. In terms of brotherly nations, and that's a completely different set of mind.
And language-wise, Ukraine, would you say that Ukraine is sort of split? You know, Ukrainian speaking and Russian speaking, or
yeah, well, it's a slow process. because there are more and more people switching to Ukrainian, and this is being aided by education in Ukrainian and more films and television programs being done in Ukrainian. So there are more people who actively can use Ukrainian for communication and self-expression.
Alisher Sadikov, how about Uzbekistan? Is Russian spoken in Uzbekistan now?
Very little and badly, you know. But it's quite popular to learn Russian within elites, you know. It's if you go to Russian school,
that's a practical language to learn.
And you go to Russian school and you find like one Russian in that school. All of them are Uzbek. So it's just the legacy that Russian schools used to teach better than local sort of language school. So this just a legacy. Otherwise, migrants who go to Moscow, if you listen how they speak Russian, you'll be amazed how they survive in that environment, you know. And that's all reason why they've been so much badly treated maybe in Russia, for knowing very little about Russia in comparison to what their parents used to know about it, about the country. So,
Harry, in Armenia, if you want to go and study at a university, which language would you study in? Would you that be an Armenian university, most likely? Or
yes, yeah, that would be. The Armenians, usually, they were very careful about their language, and we were really...
They always have been, though, right?
It was, yes, yeah. Because the language for us, it was very important for keeping our identity. So, and that's why we were doing everything possible to protect our language. So this is, even Armenians, they pretty much very close to Russian culture. They like Russian language, Russian literature. But, you know, you cannot say that Armenians are Russian speakers. They speak very good Russian language, but, you know, again, for them, Armenian language is a spoken language at home and everywhere. So this is very important for us. One thing that is unfortunate, I like very much Russian culture, and I think that they have great literature. But one thing is missing there. The Russian elite is always supporting bad guys. They promote bad guys in our political elite. They always support those who are corrupt, who are against reforms, and therefore you will never evaluate Russian influence as one that promotes or progresses your national culture or your national political culture. This is unfortunate, but this is a fact.
Why are we talking only about Russians? I mean, Soviet Union was not only about Russians. It was about great integration between countries. I believe, you know, that when Russians gone, when Soviet Union collapsed, look what's happening now between Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, between Kyrgyzstan, between Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. So they cannot agree on any question of water distribution, on electricity, energy, on transport. There's no single issue that they can agree on. So that is a big disappointment in the region. You
maybe
we need Big Brother, they say.
So yeah, exactly. Maybe they were not trying to negotiate. They were trying
to
obey the orders.
Tsars, you know, like Hans, they all, you know, Pashas, whoever you want to call them. But Russia brought great integration. And
But what is it based on? Is it based on mutual consent? Is it based on negotiations? Or is it based on the orders from Moscow?
I believe, you know, the biggest mistake from my perspective was to get rid of everything which is Soviet, including good things about Soviet Union. I mean, this is a widely known, actually, fact that there are so many good things in this post-Soviet sort of establishment. And you're trying to get rid of everything, and you're going to live with what you want to create.
Cannot say there were so many good things. It's a wrong assumption. And I think there weren't that many good things from the Soviet Union legacy. I think integration is good, okay? And it's integration, the idea of integrating economies is
but
a good
But aren't these
idea.
Countries, the former Soviet countries, trying to achieve some sort of economic integration now? There's, you have...
just talks.
The, you know,
just
it's talk. All just talk.
No, okay, it's empty.
There seems to be endless debates and disputes over gas prices and, you know...
But gas is being used as political tool to get,
desired. That's something inescapable. It's always a playing card, you know, gas.
Russia is using really energy as a tool of influence, you know. And I'm not saying that they are selling gas, in fact, in below the market price still. But, you know, again, these countries are struggling economically and they cannot really pay for the gas according to the market.
Okay. What actually I'm trying to yeah. say is very simple thing. There's a big argument, you know. It's and those who argue against independence and those who arguing for independence.
Are there still people who are arguing against independence?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, you know, you say about labor migrants, right? The same thing that happened in Uzbekistan. Those times, Karimov said, you know, if we're independent, we're going to sell our cotton, we're going to sell our oil and gold and everything. We're going to be rich and everything. We're not going to be dependent. We will get rid of child labor. Child labor is there. Dependence on Russia in terms of labor migrants, 100% there. So if before Uzbeks used to go to Moscow for exhibition, in a point of view, you know, go to museums, they go to work now and doing hard work and dirty works.
Yeah,
so you're going to cut. I'm just saying that both sides have good arguments to say. And those who are arguing for independence, they're saying, yes, we're independent now at least. And we can now at least decide our own fate and fight for better life, fight against corruption, do something better. But the second part is really hard to achieve. And these first arguments would be still strong for the next 10 years, I believe.
Okay, let me ask you this, just one thing. Don't we all need visas to go to each other's countries now?
Those countries that are members of CIS, I think they are free to travel. Mm-hmm.
Ukrainians to go to Uzbekistan. I think we do need visas to go to Uzbekistan. And it's not very, very, very near abroad for Ukraine, I should say.
Right. What I'm trying to say is that, to me, the term near abroad has ceased to exist. I mean, it's something that is used in Russia, maybe, like, you know.
Yeah. It's also invention of Kremlin.
Right. I mean, is that offensive to an Armenian person or to a Ukrainian person?
It just doesn't make sense because those countries are so far away from Ukraine that near abroad for us is Romania and Czech Republic and Slovakia.
I think people-to-people contact really got bad. You know, it's just officials meeting with Uzbek officials, meeting Ukrainian officials.
Okay,
I should say, for example, we're talking about post-Soviet space, right?
Yeah.
This is another invention because there is no post-Soviet space. There is space, for example, for Armenia, that, you know, its neighborhood is very important. Iran, Turkey, Georgia, Azerbaijan. This is our space, you know. Mm-hmm. The post-Soviet space is just a fiction, I think, to my opinion. And the empire that was holding on absolute power and abuse and we know how this empire was kept, was really described evil empire, and I agree with that, you know, and it's good that it collapsed, really.
Well, there you have it. The former Soviet space is a myth, and 20 years on, the former Soviet countries range from European democracies to North Korean-style dictatorships. Some of them are united in military and economic alliances. Some of them have fought wars against each other. But each of the former Soviet countries is striving to define its own national identity and write its own history outside of the Soviet Union. I want to thank Natalia Churikova of the Ukrainian service, Alisher Siddiqov of the Uzbek service, and Hari Tamrazian of the Armenian service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is all I have for you this week. Thanks for turning on the blender. I thank all of my participants and our producer, Tanya Kancheva. I leave you with the song Born in the USSR, written by Russian rock musician Yuri Shevchuk in 1994. Yesterday you were master of the empire, now you're an orphan, born in the USSR. I'm Pavel Butorin, take care.